Hello, this podcast governs Seminar 1 on the Law of Finance LLB Materials. Question 1, what are the sources of finance law? This question is really intended just to make sure that we understand where finance law comes from. If we're talking about finance law in England, then there are two main sources of that finance law. We have central concepts of English law, the law of England and Wales, which for our purposes are contract, tort, property, fiduciary law, equity, criminal law. And we're going to draw a lot of concepts out of those central legal areas. The second stream is then statute, which for the most part, for our purposes, originates in the European Union. So we have a number of directives dealing with financial services, whether that's ordinary banking business or whether that's investment business. And that, I think, is our key division, banking on the one hand and investment on the other. These directives create rules which, of course, are required to be implemented at the member state level by the Financial Services Authority for the most part nowadays, under the powers given to it by the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000. The 2000 Act is primarily an enabling act. It gives the Financial Services Authority a lot of powers, and then the detail of the rules is actually contained in the Financial Services Authority Handbook, which is available almost exclusively online, fsa.gov.uk. So that becomes the nitty-gritty what a lot of finance lawyers will be dealing with day after day, will be the FSA handbook. But there is also then a lot of other statute which just forms part of general English law, the Misrepresentation Act. All of the legislation we're going to talk about, basically, the contract law, tort law, trust law and everything else. Okay. So that's question one, to understand there's kind of multifaceted sources. Question two, does finance law exist, or are we making it up as we discuss it? The idea here is that finance law doesn't really exist as a field yet. We've got the central concept, contract, tort, so on and so forth. We then have the contextual fields that are well established, company law, family law, commercial law. Finance law is new and growing. It exists out there in the world only in the sense that there are things that practitioners do. There are standard market contracts in many circumstances where trade associations or groups of practitioners have formed a consensus as to how they think it should all work. But nothing more than that. It's not law in the way that company law has become law hitherto. And so it's only really since the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000 and the large number of European directives in recent years as well, particularly in the 21st century, that we're starting to see something we can call finance law developing. And the idea that we might be making it up as we discuss it is an idea that it's a brand new subject. And as we discuss how the norms of contract law should apply to finance, we are creating that. The practitioners are having those same discussions. They're creating finance law as they do that. It's really to open up an understanding that finance law is hugely creative. It involves knowing a large amount of law generally across the piece, and then being able to manipulate that law to use those structures to achieve particular ends out there in financial markets for our clients, and from the other perspective, regulators, and at a more kind of accidental level, the courts regulating financial markets as well. Question three, what happened in the global financial crisis 2007-2009? This is really all about seeing how far you can go researching and how you can find things out. Rather than wanting you necessarily to come up with all the answers at this stage, the second half of the question is the equally important bit. How will you find out about that crisis, and how will you stay up to date with developments of regulatory proposals during this module? There's a very good podcast by Gillian Tett, which we put amongst the Seminar 1 materials on Blackboard. The financial crisis really came from two sources. The principal source is subprime lending in the US, where due to over-enthusiasm in the USA among bankers, there was a tendency to lend money to people who couldn't possibly have paid that money back. There was a kind of mortgage called a ninja. No income, no job or assets, ninja. In other words, banks were lending foolishly to people who had no real means of paying their mortgages back. And when house prices fell in the USA, these people were left holding assets, which were worth a lot less than the loans they'd taken out to buy them, and they simply couldn't repay. And so the entire market collapsed. So why does that become a global panic? Well, what had been going on is something called securitization, where a large number of financial institutions had realised they could make money out of taking what are known as receivables. All the individual mortgage payments, for example, that people make on their mortgages. All the payments people make on their credit cards, so on and so forth. And realised that instead of the mortgagee sitting and waiting for thousands of people to make their monthly payments on their mortgages, you could sell off all those mortgage contracts as a block. Sell them off as a single security. Hence the word securitization comes in. And this is what banks started to do. They started to sell off these securities. And the market for this was hugely vibrant. It seemed that the property market in relation to mortgages was going up and up and up. The clever financiers realised this was a good way of getting these assets off banks' balance sheets and make profit out of them. And they got more and more complex as time went on. When the housing market collapsed, all the securitisations that had been written on mortgages collapsed as well. And so we have a huge number of banks around the world who have invested in these securitisations, now holding assets that are worthless. And what had gone on with mortgages was that more and more mortgages were subprime. In other words, they had been sold even though it was known the ninja customer, for example, couldn't possibly make a repayment. But the bank didn't care. All they wanted was another mortgage they could wrap up into a securitisation and sell off. Credit default swap then became a way of speculating on whether or not these securitisations would fail. And when the securitisations did fail, banks like Lehman Brothers had effectively written credit default swaps, a kind of insurance policy, which would pay out to anybody who had taken the speculative gamble that these products might fail if the housing market collapsed. So banks like Lehman not only had invested in lots of securitization, they'd also sold lots and lots of credit default swaps, which required them to pay out tremendous amounts of money. So it was a concatenation of circumstances which ran together. The other part of the financial crisis, what really fueled the housing boom, was cheap money. Interest rates were incredibly low, which meant it was comparatively easy for everyone to borrow because interest rates were so low. What kept interest rates so low? Well, remember that the US has been at war for a long time, Afghanistan and Iraq, spending huge amounts of money, trillions of dollars on that. And so it's remarkable that interest rates have been so low at the time when the United States has been at war. Usually, when you're at war, things get much tighter in the economy. What was going on was China has been expanding incredibly fast. And the Chinese have been very concerned about inflation at home. And so what they wanted to do is to suck a lot of the spare money out of the Chinese economy by investing it in the US. And so it's a lot of Chinese money that's been invested comparatively cheaply in the USA, which means there's been a lot of money around in the US, coming from the Chinese, effectively. And when money's plentiful like anything else, it's cheap because it's plentiful, and therefore lots of people have lots of money to spend. And so the Americans are spending like crazy. And Alan Greenspan and others at the Federal Reserve simply didn't put a lid on all of this cycle of horrible spending and everything else. So how are you going to keep up to date? Well, FT.com is going to be a very important source. You need your free subscription to FT.com, I suggest, to keep up to date with all of this. What do finance lawyers do? Make lots of money, never go home, never sleep, put in, you know, 84-hour days. Finance lawyers are risk managers. I think that's an important thing to understand about what they do. It requires knowing about the market, it requires a flexible mind. It requires to know your clients and know what they're after. It does require you to be strong. There's a herd mentality amongst finance lawyers, just as there is amongst ordinary finance traders. Everyone tends to want to do the same thing, use the same standard market contracts. It requires strength of intellect and strength of character to withstand where the herd is charging to and to think, no, what's the direction in which I want me and my clients to go? Fifth question, why are you studying this module? It's interesting to work out what your interests are. Are you studying this module because you hope it'll lead to a glittering career? That's fine. Are you studying this module because you hope it leads to riches in some way? Are you studying this module because lots of other people are studying this module and it seems like it could be fun because it's new? Are you studying it because at the time of this financial crisis, what a fascinating thing to study? Any of these reasons are fun reasons, just interesting for entire seminar groups to get a handle on what they're doing it for and to try and follow your direction, your interest within that. So that's an outline of seminar one. Have you fun with that?